The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Welcome to Discover Extra Edition. Stories from Discover, the magazine of science, that we didn't have time for in our regular monthly podcast. I'm your host, Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Episode number 12 of Discover Extra Edition contains five stories covering eating bugs, salamanders, space stations, automated cars, and ants. A new animal farm. Billions of people eat bugs. Entrepreneurs hope you will, too. In a dimly lit warehouse in Austin, Texas, a team of robots and scientists is raising millions of six-legged livestock every month. Once fully grown, they're roasted and seasoned, mixed into granola or ground into flour. The quarry? Crickets. This semi-automated commercial-scale cricket farm is the brainchild of Aspire Food Group founders Gabe Mott, Shibahita Sur, and Mohammed Ashour. When they were MBA students at McGill University in 2013, the idea won them the $1 million Hult Prize for Social Good. To launch the farm, they had to think big about Akita domesticus, the house cricket. No one had reared them for human consumption on this scale before. We had to walk away from everything in the scientific literature, Mott says. The group now runs constant tests on every bin of food that's produced, and about 1 million crickets are raised each day. Drops of water, hours of light, bits of feed, changes in temperature, all are valuable data points that help optimize the cricket life cycle, from birth to cricket flower. Pound for pound, crickets and other edible insects offer the most bang for the planet's resources. Crickets pack more protein than beef, more calcium than milk, more iron than spinach, and as many fatty acids as salmon. Crickets need just 2 pounds of food for every edible pound they become. This ratio, called the feed conversion rate, is far better than their competition. For example, cows require 25 pounds of feed per pound of beef. Because it demands so many resources, the livestock industry is a significant greenhouse gas contributor and driver of deforestation. Insects are about as clean as it gets. As Earth's population increases by billions in the coming decades, food production must double to feed everyone. The need for more protein is dire, and protein sources that are resilient are particularly important, says Ashour. That has entrepreneurs betting big that entomorphagy, or eating insects, will be an integral part of the world hunger solution. And in many places, it already is. 2 billion people eat insects regularly. But the edible bug biz is expected to grow to a whopping $720 million by 2024. Among the companies trying to fill the void are Aspire, Tiny Farms, an agricultural tech company raising crickets in Silicon Valley, and Bitty Foods, a startup selling cricket flour and snacks around the country. But these entrepreneurs and engineers must optimize the cricket to meet demand. Aspire's main concerns are scale and efficiency, so they're capturing troves of data to maximize yield. And crickets are perfect, chirpy little data generators. Their lives span just months, providing ample opportunity to analyze every moment to perfect production. The company's engineers designed feeder robots that patrol the aisles of cricket bins, adding just the right amount of food and water based on a formula improved upon via billions of cricket forebears. Over the next year or so, Ashour expects 70 to 80% of the cricket rearing process will be automated, with highly skilled workers doing the rest. They've got a ways to go, though. Next year, Aspire will scale its 25,000-square-foot operation into an adjacent building 10 times larger. Yet even this next-gen facility will create just 300,000 pounds of cricket powder annually, a drop in the bucket, Ashour admits. For comparison, humans currently consume some 8.8 billion pounds of whey powder a year. From there, they'll duplicate their design in connected facilities around the world. They've already started a pilot farm in Ghana for palm weevil larvae, another tasty insect. Eventually, billions and billions of bugs will feed data into more than 100 such farms. That should be welcome news in developing countries with high demand but little supply. But in the U.S. and Europe, the problem is psychological. Companies must remove the ick factor. That's starting to happen via protein-rich processed crickets tucked into snacks and sweets. And last year, Seisan, a Michelin 3-star restaurant in San Francisco, started serving caviar with cricket broth alongside sea urchins and whole crickets. But for an entire culture shift to occur, Ashour wants to change how we talk about entomorphology. We don't say we're eating mammals. We say beef or pork. Ashour wants to similarly rebrand bugs. So maybe entomunchies? Alternative proteins? Whatever we call them, there's a good chance more bugs will soon hit store shelves. And as we continue to refine our palate, scientists hope to satiate our eco-friendly appetites one cricket at a time. The Salamander Army. Crawling across American forests, a secretive horde of amphibians protects vast ecosystems. On a drizzly December afternoon in western Massachusetts, U.S. Geological Survey wildlife biologists Evan Grant and Adrienne Brand stop their car on the side of the road and plod into the wet forest through a break in the oaks and white pines. It's a bit late in the year to find the predators they're searching for, but this forest is teeming with them. In fact, as soon as they walk past the first tree, they are probably never more than a few feet from one. You'd never know it, though. If you walk into almost any forest, like this one in the northeastern United States, and stand still, you'll start to hear animals. At first, the songs of birds from afar will reach you. Then the ones nearby that went silent at your approach will start back up. After a while, you might hear some rustling in the leaves nearby. Chipmunks, squirrels, or other small mammals, and maybe a snake or two. But as long as you stand, and as silent as you may be, what you'll never hear, and probably never see, are these predators, the most common terrestrial vertebrates in the woods. Fortunately, unless you're a small bug, you're not in any danger. The ubiquitous critters are eastern red-backed salamanders. Skinny, lungless amphibians, a couple of inches long, with a rust-colored racing stripe down their backs. And in forests from Nova Scotia to Minnesota and down south to North Carolina, there are often more Plethodon serenius than any other land animal with a backbone. Their sheer weight is greater than all the nearby birds and small mammals combined. From the east coast to the west, those tremendous numbers are showing scientists just how important salamanders are to the forests that surround them. If you are an insect, red-backed salamanders should indeed strike fear into your open circulatory system. Their voracious nature and their numbers make these salamanders crucial parts of the forest food web, according to Carrie Ann Hickerson, who studies the small amphibians at John Carroll University in Ohio. They have the ability to create trophic cascades in the forest that filter all the way down to the level of the leaf litter, says Hickerson, referring to the predator's ability to shape populations beyond those they directly feed on. By eating the bugs that eat or break down dead leaves, salamanders can alter the flow of nutrients and chemicals on the forest floor. And they keep prey populations under control, maintaining a balanced food web. But they're not just predators. They're also protein-rich prey for raccoons, snakes, wild turkeys, and other animals, funneling nutrients from small insects to larger forest critters. Since 1975, scientists have known about the staggering numbers of red-backed salamanders living under rocks, logs, and leaves. That year, a study in New Hampshire estimated there were about 750,000 salamanders per square mile, or about one salamander for every 6 foot square of forest floor. But researchers' techniques, typical at the time, weren't up to modern standards. So in 2014, University of Missouri herpetologist Ray Semlich reevaluated salamander populations. He was inspired after discovering that salamander populations in the Ozarks were significantly higher than the 1975 estimates. His team eventually found that the density nationwide, in forests where salamanders live, was on average 8 times higher than what scientists reported in 1975. "We really think that they're playing a greater role than we ever imagined they're playing," Semlich, who died in 2015, said at the time. These woodland salamanders are also out west. Ensetina scholitzii, usually just referred to as Ensetina, lives in forests from British Columbia to Baja California. "I like to think of them as the stewards of the forest," says biologist Michael Best of the College of Redwoods in Northern California. He studied Ensetina for over a decade, and in 2014 found that one salamander in an outdoor enclosure could slow down leaf decay by about 15%. The implication? These salamanders could sequester 80 tons of carbon on the forest floor every year. That's equal to a car driving 650,000 miles. And overall, salamanders create stability on the forest floor, Best says. The amphibians stash nutrients, both in their bodies and in the leaves whose decomposition they slow down, and keep the nutrients around until other organisms can use them. They are moderating the swings of chaos, Best says. There are some caveats to these findings. Food webs are almost endlessly complex, and not all studies on salamanders have shown such huge ecosystem effects. But Daniel Hocking of Frostburg State University in Maryland says that with over 5,000 salamanders in an area the size of a football field, it's hard to imagine they're not having any influence on food webs and ecosystems. Such a widespread species is not in danger of extinction, but there are troubling signs. Invasive earthworms seem to be pushing salamanders from their preferred habitat in some Ohio forests, says Hickerson. And there's the recently discovered salamander-killing fungus called B-Sal, short for Batrachochytrium salamandrivorans, which researchers worry could spread to the U.S. from Asia. And of course, there's climate change. Grant, the USGS amphibian researcher in Massachusetts, is part of a network of researchers throughout the redback salamander's range, hoping to figure out how they will adjust. Climate change models predict reduced snowfall. Without that insulating layer, deeper forest floor layers may freeze when extreme cold sweeps down from the north. That could force salamanders to burrow deeper in the soil, delaying their emergence in the spring, Grant says. To emulate this, Grant has been going into forests and shoveling off snow from grids of wooden boards, under which salamanders love to hide. Keeping half the boards snow-free in winter and leaving the other half snowy as an experimental control can show him how the salamanders might fare in coming decades. Grant and Brand are checking those boards on this December day. Brand flips a board over and calls out that she's found one. It's a young red-backed salamander, probably less than a year old, Grant estimates, and just an inch long from nose to tail tip. Its large, dark eyes bug out from a flattened head covered in faint pale dots. It seems impossible that something so tiny could make any difference to the enormous forest surrounding it. But its power sinks in when you start to realize that it's part of an elusive army, tens of millions strong. Everything worth knowing about space stations. The first step toward the final frontier. From the first space station, the Soviet Union's Salyut, in 1971, to the International Space Station, ISS, still circling the Earth, these bastions provide safe harbor for human and plant, insect, and rodent adventurers beyond our atmosphere. In a nutshell, space station science revolves around what the station largely lacks: gravity. Decades into the space era, we're still figuring out the harm and help that microgravity can offer, from bone loss in astronauts to ink flow in pens and printers. Stations also let us test technology longer than the 2 weeks at a time the space shuttle program could manage. That's a necessity before we take the long trip to Mars and beyond. And solving space's challenges can also benefit life back on terra firma. For instance, research into astronaut bone loss can help non-spacefarers with osteoporosis. The future of ISS. By 2024, NASA hopes to divest itself of ISS and turn the station over to private companies. These companies could do research and launch experiments into low Earth orbit, much like they do now, though potentially with more advertising and commercialization. The plan, considered since the Obama administration, became the Trump administration's preferred choice in February. But there are arguments on all sides against giving up the most expensive object ever built, a project that's cost taxpayers more than $100 billion. NASA already collaborates with industry, from the research conducted aboard ISS to the cargo now ferried by SpaceX and Orbital ATK. However, transferring the Mammoth project would allow the space community to continue reaping the station's benefits while letting NASA redirect its multi-billion-dollar annual ISS budget toward the space station of the future. Gateway to the Moon and beyond. If humans are to explore beyond Earth's orbit, they'll need a place to test new technologies and a base of operations. A station orbiting the Moon can provide both. It would be far enough away to serve as a trial run for upcoming deep space missions, like crewed trips aboard NASA's Orion capsule, a new spacecraft that could travel as far as Mars, and lunar orbit is close enough to home for repairs and rescues, should anything go amiss. These goals are driving NASA and fellow space agencies around the globe to build Deep Space Gateway, the first lunar space mission. The mission is still being planned, but NASA hopes to launch the power and propulsion systems as soon as 2022, with a pressurized habitation module to follow in 2023, and an airlock and additional pressurized modules afterward. Orion holds 4 crew members, so Gateway has to accommodate at least that many. However, this station won't be continuously occupied like the ISS, and it is unlikely to match ISS's football field size. Instead, NASA envisions small crews staying 1 to 2 months, with most maintenance and resupply work likely done by robotic missions. In this way, Gateway's name and intended use become clear. It will not be a home away from home, like ISS, but a true space station, akin to a train station. In some ways, Gateway would continue ISS's work as an all-around science lab, featuring projects ranging from cell biology to astrophysics. In addition to low gravity, Gateway would allow radiation tests from outside Earth's protective Van Allen belts, a more realistic test for the more distant and irradiated missions of the future. But the real value would come from Gateway's prime location and ability to change its orbital path to suit various mission dictates. That might mean low orbits to support astronauts or robots exploring the lunar surface, or flying high to rendezvous with deep space flights, including those NASA hopes to send to Mars by the 2030s. A red footprint. Humans won't stop at the Moon. Someday, we'll go to Mars. And to make Martian trips commonplace, for the same reasons Gateway makes sense, we'll need a station circling Mars, too. That's why Lockheed Martin is working on what it calls Mars Base Camp, which might launch as early as 2028. There, astronauts would prepare to set foot on the Red Planet. Everything worth knowing. Autonomous cars. Bots on wheels. Most car crashes are due to human error. Remove drivers and the roads get safer. Self-driving vehicles have a lot to master, though. They must see and think in real-world road situations, reacting to their surroundings. That might mean swerving around a child who suddenly runs into the street, or gauging whether to cross an intersection on a yellow light. And polls show that people are nervous about riding in a driverless vehicle, despite the claims that roads will be less dangerous with bots in charge. But ready or not, driverless cars are coming soon to a street near you. Seeing. Taking a glance at the primary sensors that enable driverless vehicles to know their surroundings. First, LIDAR, light detection and ranging. LIDAR emits lasers that bounce off objects to measure distance. It's especially good for long-range detection. Some systems sense objects nearly 1,000 feet away. And these aren't blurry images. LIDAR creates high-resolution 3D maps of shapes, including pedestrians, curbs, and other vehicles. Second, cameras. Cameras are the most cost-effective of the three sensors. They have a decent range and are good at spotting lane markings and traffic lights, but they're not as accurate as radar and LIDAR. Third, radar. Radar uses radio waves to detect the position and speed of other objects. Police officers use it to catch speeding drivers, and air traffic controllers use it to track planes. As adapted for robo-vehicles, the technology can detect objects from a few feet away to hundreds of feet away, but radar can't determine shapes. Thinking. Self-driving vehicles must quickly understand and interpret what they see. Software and algorithms make this happen. One way is through artificial neural networks, which are computer systems that mimic the human brain. These neural networks let robot cars understand, react, and learn in real time from the sensor data. This artificial intelligence is the mind of the self-driving vehicle. Levels of automation. In 2014, SAE International, an association of tech professionals, created the standard classification for vehicle autonomy levels. They range from a human in full control to the car in full control. Levels 1 and 2 include advanced driver assistance systems, ADAs, which offer a helping hand, like watching your blind spots. Levels 3 to 5 involve automated driving systems, ADS, upping the ante of bot control. Level 0 is, you're driving. Level 1, you're driving, but ADAs help with acceleration and steering. Level 2, you're driving, but ADAs can fully control acceleration, braking, and steering under some circumstances. Level 3, ADS fully controls the car in some circumstances, but you're ready to take over. Level 4, ADS performs all driving functions in certain situations, and you don't need to pay attention. Level 5, the vehicle drives, and you sit as a passenger. Race to market. By 2040, annual sales of self-driving cars could exceed 33 million. Currently, only cars up to level 2 are available to the public. By 2021, BMW says it will be selling level 3, and Ford says it will be selling level 4 to consumers. That's all great, but regulations will need to keep pace. Since 2011, 21 states have passed autonomous vehicle legislation, and 5 others have governor-issued executive orders. In general, the laws limit the vehicles on public roads to level 2, though some states have opened roads to researchers to test cars at level 3 and higher. At the federal level, existing laws were written with human drivers in mind, but the U.S. Senate is considering a bill that would provide some regulatory framework for autonomous cars. ANSI? Ride-sharing companies Lyft and Uber offer autonomous car trips on the streets of Boston and Pittsburgh, with a driver at the wheel in case something goes wrong. In the meantime, save your pennies. The first generation of truly driverless vehicles is expected to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. Skeptical public. Would you be comfortable riding in a driverless car? 56% of Americans say no, citing lack of trust and safety concerns, according to a 2017 Pew Research Center survey. In March, an Uber self-driving vehicle in Tempe, Arizona, hit and killed a woman crossing a street, further stoking public fear. Another study, using machine learning to analyze the language in more than 1 trillion social media posts, found that Americans are most afraid of autonomous cars being hijacked by hackers. Twenty things you didn't know about ants. 1. At home on every continent but Antarctica, the ant family, Formicidae, has more than 15,000 species. 2. Their habitats range from rainforest canopies to the Sahara Desert, with most ants living in hierarchical colonies with a single egg-laying queen. Males' sole job is mating, and female workers do everything else. 3. Ants may be stereotyped as picnic pests, but they're an important cleanup crew. A 2014 study of New York City streets estimated that every year, arthropods pick up the equivalent of 60,000 hot dogs in dropped food waste, just along the road medians of 150 city blocks. 4. Sometimes ants end up on the menu themselves. When in Colombia, try the delicacy hormigas colonas, literally big-bottomed ants. Fertilized queens of a large leafcutter species, served brined and toasted. 5. Considered an aphrodisiac, the crunchy queens are given as a wedding gift there, as well as in Venezuela. 6. Tribes in Kerala, India, treat swollen joints and infected skin with a medicinal oil of crushed weaver ants. 7. We don't recommend rubbing your body with ants, but if you do, watch out for the formic acid found in the venom of many species, including fire ants. 8. Naturally antimicrobial, formic acid is good for more than giving bites and stings their zing, whether you've got 6 legs or 2. Humans put it in laundry detergents and hand soaps, while wood ants mix it with tree resin to create a kind of hygienic paint for their nests. 9. A tidy nest takes lots of work, and around 60 species of ants enslave other species to do their bidding, often by stealing brood and raising them as their own workers. But sometimes slave ants revolt, attacking their overlords, attempting to mate and lay eggs, and even making a run for freedom. 10. Dracula ants, a range of species found across the world, earn their name by drinking the hemolymph, essentially ant blood, of their own larvae, but without killing them. 11. The queens of one such species, Stigmatama sylvestrii, seem to survive solely on the lifeblood, or at least the hemolymph, of the young. 12. If you've ever squashed the odorous house ant, a common intruder in North American homes, your nose will know. When smushed, the ants release a chemical from the same family of methyl ketones that gives blue cheese its distinctive funk. 13. The Kangang tribe of Brazil wouldn't dream of squishing an ant. They believe their ancestors' spirits go on to live in another life in the form of these humble arthropods. 14. Speaking of ancestors, a 100-million-year-old piece of amber found in Charente, France, contains the oldest ant fossil ever found. 15. The ants don't always go marching. Tree-dwelling Melissoterus can't walk on flat surfaces. The widespread but elusive African ants evolved a middle pair of legs that projects upward rather than downward. Awkward for flat surfaces, but perfect for navigating the tunnels they dig for their nests. 16. While walking is off the table, spinning isn't. Melissoterus workers are the only ants that can spin silk, which they use to seal their tunnels. 17. Trapjaw ants are quite the acrobats. In addition to jumping forward, members of at least one species can also catapult themselves backward by quickly snapping shut their spring-loaded jaws on a hard surface, propelling themselves over 100 times the length of their body. 18. Also going to great lengths, researchers have documented Argentine ants forming super colonies around the world. Ants in these massive interconnected nests collaborate rather than compete with other colonies. 19. The largest super colony ever found spans roughly 2,500 miles. It follows first the Atlantic coast and then the Mediterranean, from northwestern Spain to northern Italy. Researchers estimate the supercolony's population boasts tens of millions of queens, and worker ants in the billions. 20. Ants from a nest in Portugal that's part of this supercolony are just as friendly to each other as they would be to their supercolony compatriots in France. That sounds like a social network we can all learn from. That wraps up this episode of Discover Extra Edition. I hope you've enjoyed it and will tune in to another podcast soon. Until then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.